This is KCBX Central Coast Public Radio. You're listening to Issues and Ideas, where local voices tell the stories that keep the Central Coast connected. I'm David McAbee. On this week's show, Gianna Patchen returns with People and the Planet. She talks with Kara Woodruff, member of the Diablo Canyon Decommissioning Panel and policy advisor to Senator John Layard, about the future of the Central Coast energy landscape. Then Carol Tangeman chats with Bob Revel of the Morro Bay Bird Festival as birders near and far prepare to flock to the coast for next year's bird festival. And finally, news correspondent Natalia Young talks with the Slo County Food Bank about how they're preparing to meet the community needs amid recent government shutdowns. It's energy, wildlife, and the heart of helping, all coming up on Issues and Ideas.
Hello, this is Gianna Patchen, and welcome to People and the Planet. People and the Planet highlights local environmental leaders and explores the interconnection between our communities and our Earth. To briefly introduce myself, I'm your host, Gianna Patchen. I work as the chapter coordinator for the Santa Lucia chapter of the Sierra Club, representing San Luis Obispo County. Our chapter strives to support all Slo County communities through environmental advocacy, education, community building, and legislative engagement. A caveat that People and the Planet's guests do not represent the Sierra Club. And with that, I'm excited to welcome my guest, Kara Woodruff, who is the San Luis Obispo County District Director and Senior Policy Advisor to California Senator John Layard. Kara has lived in San Luis Obispo for over 30 years. As a former project director for national nonprofits, Kara negotiated and raised funds for the conservation of over 100,000 acres of San Luis Obispo County, including Hearst Ranch and in the Carrizo Plain. She is a member of the Diablo Canyon Decommissioning Engagement Panel and an author of the panel's strategic vision. At the Sierra Club, I have the immense privilege of collaborating with Kara on an array of Slo County environmental efforts. Welcome, Kara. Thank you for being here today.
Oh, it's a pleasure. Thank you, Gianna.
I'm really excited to talk with you more about this really pressing local issue. But before we dive in, can you start off by introducing yourself to our audience?
Sure. My name is Kara Woodruff, and I'm the district director for Senator John Layard. Senator Layard represents the 17th Senate District, which includes Santa Cruz County, Monterey County, San Benito County, and most of San Luis Obispo County, including the Diablo Canyon Power Plant and the lands that surround them, the 12,000-acre Diablo Canyon lands.
Thank you for sharing a bit more about your work and Laird's work as well. We're here today to talk about a very specific issue, the conservation of the Diablo Canyon lands. Can you share an overview of what's going on right now?
Sure. So this community has been talking about the conservation of and public access to the 12,000-acre Diablo Canyon lands for over 25 years. It started back in the year 2000 when there was a ballot measure that was before the San Luis Obispo County voters known as the DREAM Initiative. And the simple question was, should we protect and conserve and make available for the community the Diablo Canyon lands? And 75% of the people voting said yes. So this is something this community has worked on for a long time. More recent efforts have been the California Natural Resources Agency did a report a couple years ago calling for the conservation and public access of those lands. There's also been efforts by the Friends of Diablo Canyon Lands, who developed a conservation framework. And even SB 846, which was passed by the state legislature in 2022, that extended Diablo Canyon power plant's life for 5 years, even there called for the conservation of the Diablo Canyon lands. So after all these years and all these activities, and that's just the top of it, there have been many others. So after all this community activity and even statewide activity to promote the conservation and public access to the Diablo Canyon lands, we finally have an opportunity to make this vision a reality. And that's at this week's meeting of the California Coastal Commission on November 6th.
Amazing. Thank you, Kara. It's really been a long time coming to see the Diablo Canyon lands protected. Before we dive deeper into the issue, can you share with the audience what we're talking about when we say Diablo Canyon lands?
Yeah, sure. So the Diablo Canyon lands are 12,000 acres and they stretch over 20 miles. And they're located between Avila Beach and Montana de Oro or Morro Bay. They are the lands that surround the Diablo Canyon Power Plant, which is the last remaining nuclear plant in the state of California. And there are already a few trails that are on the lands, but people have been asking for more than that, to have access to the entire ability to cross those lands on a trail, and to preserve the really unique ecological and other resources that are on that land. So, for example, it's 20 miles of a coastal strip in the state of California. Very, very hard to find that today. Most of that land has been developed and fragmented. So this land is still, for the most part, untouched, unfragmented, and has a rich ecological landscape. The lands are also really important to local tribes. Those lands have really unique and precious tribal resources that need to be protected. And the scenic views are incredible. So by protecting the Diablo Canyon lands, we're giving people an outlet for great hiking, we're preventing fragmentation and undermining the ecological resources, and protecting in perpetuity cultural and scenic resources. So it's a really cool opportunity.
For anyone who's been out on the Point Bouchon Trail, that is part of the Diablo Canyon lands.
Right.
And one of the places where we all get to get a glimpse of that really beautiful coastal landscape that we don't otherwise get to see.
Absolutely.
So you shared with us just a little bit about the history that has led us to this urgent moment to protect the Diablo Canyon lands. Can you share just a little more about what has led us to this moment that we are in?
So as I mentioned, a couple of years ago, the state legislature authorized Diablo Canyon Power Plant to extend its operations. The plant has two units. Those were expected to close by 2025. And SB 846, a state law that was signed by the governor, authorized the plant to extend until 2030. But in order to actually extend the plant, the operator, PG&E, needs a license to do so. And getting that license has many, many steps. And one of them is to receive permits under state and federal law by the California Coastal Commission. So on November 6th, the Coastal Commission will consider whether or not to issue those permits. And if they do, what kind of mitigation measures will be attached to them. And that's very, very important. If we extend Diablo Canyon's operation for 5 more years, that is 5 years of significant environmental impacts. And let me share with you some language that was included in the staff report about those impacts. The plant's operation, specifically its use of ocean water for cooling the reactors, which is known as entrainment, affects about 14 square miles of nearshore habitat, representing a substantial annual loss of marine life, productivity, and public trust resources. So the state and federal laws require that these impacts, which will be directly associated with Diablo's continued operation, be mitigated. And importantly, the Coastal Commission said that land conservation, which protects the watershed and the coast, is the most feasible and likely to succeed of the various mitigation measures available. So in sum, the Coastal Commission is considering whether to issue those permits, and I think they will. But really importantly, what kind of mitigation will they require to offset the impacts that this extended operation of Diablo Canyon Power Plant will bring?
Mm-hmm. So just to repeat back to you what I heard and double checking that me and our audience understand, Diablo Canyon's operations have impacts on the marine ecosystems in the water off the coast.
Absolutely.
And then this decision that's happening this week on November 6th is deciding how we mitigate those impacts, and they're considering land as part of a mitigation for that. Could you explain more about how land protections can help us protect our ocean as well?
Yeah, I can say there's a really great explanation of the connection of the health of the land and the coastal and marine environment. It's in the Coastal Commission staff report. So if you really want to dive deep and understand that, I recommend you check out the staff report. In fact, this item is item 8 and 9 on Thursday's Coastal Commission agenda, and they have a specific appendix that goes into great length about impacts associated with the plant's operation and how protection of the land can meaningfully improve the habitat on the marine and coastal environment. There might be other ways that could be more direct in protecting the water resources, but many of them have been deemed unfeasible. So, for example, when San Onofre closed, they talked a long time about mitigation for San Onofre impacts, and reefs and other activities actually in the water have been attempted to be constructed. But those are not as successful as we had hoped them to be. So when you consider all the options out there, it turns out that land conservation is probably the best, most reliable way to improve and enhance and support marine habitat, which has the side benefit of also protecting the lands, which also were really precious ecologically as well. What's interesting is the staff report then recommends particular mitigation measures to protect the land, and it is the perspective of Senator Laird, my boss, as well as Supervisor Gibson, and many, many others, that their recommended land conservation mitigation measures don't go nearly far enough. And so what we're promoting is that the Coastal Commission actually save enough land to really offset all those impacts. It turns out that even what we're recommending probably won't be enough. So we view it as a bare minimum number of steps to protect the land and by design, the marine resources. And I can go into detail about what that means.
We could talk all day about this.
Yes, we could.
Well, just for our audience, the Sierra Club is asking for the land protections as well as direct protections in the ocean that help mitigate the impacts, like a reef.
I think that's terrific.
So we're looking for a whole gambit, right? Ask for as much protection as we can. In that realm, could you share a little bit more with our audience about what the California Coastal Commission recommends right now and what we as community leaders are asking them to do instead?
Sure. So let's talk about conservation of the land. The staff report recommends that we should put conservation easements on portions of the land and otherwise protect it. But what Senator Laird and the Sierra Club and many others are arguing for is a much more comprehensive land protection package. And to understand that, we have to break down what the Diablo Canyon lands are. So there's three major pieces, and they all surround the Diablo Canyon power plant. So the land to the north of the plant is called North Ranch. And the land to the south of the plant is called South Ranch. And then there's an additional piece called Wild Cherry Canyon, which is east of South Ranch. So if you add up North Ranch, South Ranch, and Wild Cherry Canyon, you get to 12,000 acres. So if we are going to, we're promoting a plan that would protect all of North Ranch and all of South Ranch by the use of a conservation easement. And a conservation easement basically says, these are the things you cannot do that undermine the conservation values. They restrict future development. That is then recorded to the land and will forever protect that land against future uses that would undermine the resources. In addition, we're calling for a confusing thing called a right of first refusal, but in short, it protects the resources of Wild Cherry Canyon. It's a little complicated because that land is under litigation, but the net result of everything we're asking for is conservation on all 12,000 acres, plus coastal trails across the entire acreage, plus a management endowment so that a third party can actually design, operate, and manage those trails for years to come.
So thinking about that future, if we are able to protect all 12,000 acres of this land, what could the future of this land look like? Are we talking about public access, potential tribal ownership, potential land conservation? I know it's not set in stone at this moment in time, but envisioning what we could have, what would that look like for SLO County?
So SLO County has done a lot of envisioning about this, and I turn to those activities that have already done about the future and the vision of the Diablo Canyon lands, and they're all in sync with one another. All these separate activities came to the same conclusion, and it looks like this. Those lands that are still open, unfragmented, undeveloped, and ecologically supportive of the wildlife and protective of the cultural resources will remain. So when you look out there 50 years from now, it's going to look largely the same. We would also anticipate a future where some of the lands is owned by a local tribe. Yaktichi-Tichi Yaktilhini tribe's ancestors inhabited that land for over 10,000 years, and we think they have the rightful place to have an ownership of those lands in the future. We can also anticipate on some of the more heavily used properties like Wild Cherry Canyon, it could be owned by a nonprofit conservation group or maybe a state agency. But at the end of the day, people would have access to the land. They could start near Avila Beach and walk over 20 miles, connecting through the Irish Hills and along the coast all the way up to Montana de Oro. There would be trails in place that would be artfully and carefully designed so that in inviting this public access, we weren't undermining the very ecological and cultural resources we strive to protect. And in short, it will be a very large extension to Montana de Oro, which provides open space, recreational opportunities, and conservation for ourselves and future generations.
That's such a beautiful future that I hope we get to have.
Me too.
If you're just joining us, this is Issues and Ideas, and I'm your host, Gianna Patchen. Today, I'm talking to Kara Woodruff, who is the San Luis Obispo County District Director for California Senator John Laird. So as we get to the end of our program, I want to make it clear to our audience that protecting all 12,000 acres of this land is not guaranteed right now.
Right.
We're seeing the California Coastal Commission staff report potentially recommend as little as 1,100 acres, which is less than 10% of those lands.
It's crazy.
How can folks advocate for the full protection? What are we encouraging folks to ask for, and how can they use their voice?
It is too late right now for people to submit written comments to the Coastal Commission. That deadline has passed. But there are ways that people can participate in this hearing and let their voice for conservation be heard. First, they can participate on the November 6th Coastal Commission meeting, items 8 and 9, by Zoom online. And you can sign up to participate in public comment during those hearing items. Secondly, if you have the ability to be in Sacramento and be physically present, that would be wonderful. So I encourage it wholeheartedly. But for the vast majority of us who can't make it to Sacramento, then I would go to the Coastal Commission website, sign up to speak by the day before, which would be Wednesday, November 5th, and then be prepared to speak on Thursday, November 6th, in support of conservation of the Diablo Canyon lands. If you can be in Sacramento, you have a little bit more time. The evening before the hearing, you can sign up to participate as a person in the meeting itself. But for the rest of us, just go on to the Coastal Commission's website and sign up to speak. And if you can't find it and the Coastal Commission site gets confusing, there's a faster way to get information about how to provide public comment. And that's by going to the website for the Friends of the Diablo Canyon Land. If you can't get to the Coastal Commission website easily, check out the Friends of the Diablo Canyon Lands website. It's at diablocanyonlands.org, and just press the tab that says Action Alert, and there you will find instructions on how to participate in the Coastal Commission's hearing.
Thank you, Kara. And I'll just let our audience know, I'm going to be on that Zoom call. I hope to see all of you on that Zoom call. And again, the Zoom call itself for the California Coastal Commission meeting is November 6th. The California Coastal Commission meeting is hosted on Zoom and in person. So this Thursday, November 6th, myself, Kara, many others will be showing up on Zoom and in person to this California Coastal Commission. That's Thursday, November 6th, agenda items 8 and 9 on the California Coastal Commission's upcoming meeting. And I encourage all y'all to go to DiabloCanyonLands.org to learn how you can submit comments, see some of the talking points we talked about today, and walk you through how to submit that speaker request form. Because if you want to talk on Thursday, you have to submit that by Wednesday, the November 5th. So we hope to see you there. And Kara, are there any other ways our listeners can support the Diablo Canyon Lands conservation?
Absolutely. Just get informed. You mentioned the DiabloCanyonLands.org website. There's a lot of information there about the units of the Diablo Canyon Lands, what these efforts have been over the last 25 years to see them protected. So get informed. Know your talking points. Speak up for conservation once and for all. This is something the community has been working on for 25 years. It's high time that we secure these lands' conservation into the future.
Thank you, Kara. And to emphasize for our audience, it will take public participation to see this reality happen. So we hope you'll join us in asking for what we want, which is a protected Central Coast.
Thank you so much.
Thanks, Kara. Thanks for joining and sharing your
My
expertise
pleasure.
And passion today. It's always great to talk with you.
A pleasure. Thank you.
Talk with you later. Bye.
Bye.
That was Kara Woodruff from Senator John Laird's office talking to us about the local effort to protect the Diablo Canyon lands. This is Issues and Ideas. I'm Gianna Patchen, and you're listening to People and the Planet.
This is Issues and Ideas on KCBX Public Radio. I'm Carol Tangeman, and my guest today is Bob Revel of the Morro Bay Bird Festival. It's January 15th to the 19th, 2026. Tickets, morrobaybirdfestival.org. We are talking to Bob now because tickets just went on sale on Saturday. So, some events sell out quickly. We want to make sure KCBX listeners have an opportunity to get tickets early for some of the more popular field trips. So, Bob, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for having us back again this year.
Oh, always. And I, like I said, I want to do it early so our listeners, have a
right.
chance. Because I've looked at it and I think things sell out quickly in some cases.
They do. When we open up on Saturday morning, we have a lot of regulars that come year after year after year. And they're sitting there at 8.00.00 with their fingers on the keyboard.
Yeah.
And
well, it's still yeah. early. It's still yeah. just been open for a couple of days. And one of the things that always strikes me is on the website, it says where world-class birding meets small-town hospitality. And, I mean, that can't be overstated. There's a lot going on with this festival. It's incredible.
It really is. We like that new logo or slogan because, number one, it is a world-class bird festival. We know it's ranked in the top five in the U.S., if not the world.
Wow.
And then we have the small town of Morro Bay and the Central Coast to offer to.
Mm-hmm.
And speaking about being able to get more trips, we have 263 events this year. And that's an all-time record for us. So there's plenty of good trips to go on and presentations to hear and special events.
Yeah. Tell me about, just quickly, a favorite event. Like what's...
Well, this year, my favorite event is going to be, we have a VIP coming. His name is Greg Miller.
Mm-hmm.
And Greg is a guy who back in 1998 did what's called a big year. A big year is when a birder goes out and tries to see as many birds as he can in one year. And so Greg embarked on this in 1998, and he was going all around the United States and up to Alaska, chasing birds. And he kept running into the same two other gentlemen doing the same thing. And they would always show up at the same place because they were monitoring this rare bird alert. And so it kind of became kind of a competition. And someone heard about it and wrote a book about it. And I think it was in 2010, Hollywood picked up on it and turned it into a movie called The Big Year. And it starred Steve Martin, Owen Wilson, and Jack Black.
Oh, now that just sounds like too much fun.
Okay. Well, Greg Miller was played by Jack Black in the movie. And Greg is coming, and we're going to show the movie on Friday afternoon in the Bay Theater in Morro Bay.
That sounds great. Good. When you say a bird, you said a bird, a rare bird alert.
Right.
What is that?
Well, back in the pre-internet time, you used to have to call a phone number to get off of a list server. If someone saw a rare bird, they wanted to add it to their account. And sometimes it meant being in Florida and flying to Alaska and jumping on another little airplane to go look for it somewhere.
Wow.
And,
so people keep track. I mean, I sound like mm-hmm. I know nothing about birding, but people keep track of birds that they've seen. Like they have like, they check off the ones they've seen. Oh,
yes.
Fun.
But today we have some really cool tools on the internet that you can get instant messaging about those kind of things. But yeah, there are a lot of people that are bird chasers.
Yeah. Do you do that?
I would if I had some time.
Yeah. Well, you won't with this festival. My goodness, it looks like just a lot of work. And I must say that the website is beautiful. The events are presented in great detail. I get excited about local birding just from the photography.
We have some amazing photographers, and some of their photos are posted on our website. Jeanette is our website chairperson, website master. And but we have an incredible group of photographers coming to the festival. Several of them are offering what are called master classes, mm-hmm. and that's where you can go and learn to be a better photographer.
Yeah, I saw that, mm-hmm. and there was a beginner one too. I think like photography 101. Is that something the beginner class? Let's say someone says, "Oh, I'd love to just get in a little more about birding and photography." Could they just use their iPhone?
Absolutely. You... Yeah, okay. They could. Yes. And
any phone, I should say, not just an iPhone.
Any kind of device like that. We also have beginning birding classes for people who aren't into birding, but want to start learning about it. And, mm-hmm. and we have offer those too.
Yeah. I thought it was interesting on your site. You had all the pictures, a lot of the birds or all the birds that you're likely to see on land and mm-hmm. then over the water.
Correct.
Beautiful, beautiful photography.
It is. It is. We have amazing photographers in our area here.
Yeah. Is there a new event that you're excited about?
Well, we've got a couple of things this year. One is we're offering a cruise on the Chablis Cruise, it's called, and that includes lunch. And we'll have one of our VIP leaders on there.
Mm-hmm.
That's new this year. I think that's probably the newest event that we added this year.
Yeah. Which events do you find that you get a ton of positive feedback every year about, or does it vary?
It really varies. People we're expecting people from all over the United States to come. I think last year we had about 30 or 35 states represented. This year we're advertising in more of the magazines, and we're getting a bigger feedback prior to the festival. A lot of people are coming. They're coming primarily because they want to see some birds that we have out here that they don't see where they are. Right. There's a lot of West Coast birds. The other thing that's unique about Morro Bay, too, is it's a winter stopover for all the migrating birds that nest up in the Arctic and then head down here in the wintertime. So I think those are the biggest draws in terms of exciting birds to see.
Yeah. And coincidentally, the weather in the winter is wonderful in Morro Bay.
Yes, it is. So
That's kind of a win-win. I was in a kayak on the bay. I feel like this was right around Easter time. And of course, I can't remember what, but they were big birds and they had these big kind of ratty-looking nests all in a bunch of trees right near the shore.
Those sound like they were the cormorants that were nesting in the rookery that's near the inn at Morro Bay and the Natural
exactly
History Museum.
It.
Yes, that's a rookery. It's used by cormorants and also egrets and herons.
Mm-hmm.
And it's an interesting sight to be there when they're all in there with the young coming out. It's pretty interesting.
It was. I thought, how lucky am I to live here?
Yes.
Just one of those opportunities. If you're just joining us, this is Issues and Ideas on KCBX Public Radio. I'm Carol Tangeman. My guest today is Bob Revel of the Morro Bay Bird Festival. And it's January 15th to the 19th, and that's a Thursday through Monday, 2026. Tickets are at MorroBayBirdFestival.org. They just went on sale Saturday, November 1st. So lots of great events. And the website, like I said, is so it's so easy to look around and choose things. Do you have any tips maybe for someone who is new at this, you know, like what do I choose with all these events?
Yeah. Well, I think the first thing would be helpful would be to decide if you want to go on a field trip, which means you go out and with a leader and look at birds, or would you prefer to be in a classroom and see a presentation? I think look at that first, and then kind of maybe then if you decide to go on a field trip, then think about where you would like to go. Our trips go as far north as the Piedras Blancas Lighthouse. We go east all the way out to the Kern Wildlife Refuge and Carrizo Plain. We go south down to Oso Flacco Lake, and we also have boat trips going 30 miles offshore. We call those pelagic trips because there are birds out there that never come ashore, and they can only be seen out there. So I think you would pick the type of trip you wanted to go on and the area.
Yeah. Those field trips do sound like fun.
Yeah.
I noticed too that you pair up with other groups because, you know, we've got the otters and the beavers. So you had looks like a field trip with the Slow Beaver Brigade in Atascadero.
We do. I think they're running actually two trips.
Uh-huh.
And we have a docent who is also leading trips to look at the otters in Morro Bay. So we cover both of those, yes.
Okay. And the art opportunities. There was one that said bird carving. I assume that's wood.
It is wood.
Okay.
Yes.
And then watercolor and sketching.
Yes. Those are all going to take place at the Art Center in Morro Bay. The last year was our first year. I believe they called it seabird carving then. They carved a shorebird.
Uh-huh.
And this year they're doing a green heron. And they bring all the supplies, and it should be a lot of fun.
And then you get to carve a heron.
You get to carve it, and then you can take it home and paint it. Yes. And I think they bring Band-Aids. That's needed.
Yeah, right. Oh, gosh. I saw Sharon Lovejoy's name as well on there. She wrote those wonderful books about gardening, and it looks like she's doing nature journaling.
Yes, she is. I think she's doing four events for us. Most of those take place at San Luis Obispo Botanical Gardens, and she is a personal friend, and we're just pleased to have her back. Yeah, she's really great.
Oh, wonderful, wonderful. That just sounds really good. And I know there must be challenges, many challenges, putting on an event of this scale. How big a group do you have? You know, what's the organization like?
Okay, our organization, we have a planning committee, and we have about 20 members on that committee, and obviously everybody has a job. We have, I think right now, 142 event leaders. That lead those 269 events, if you will. And so we've got a large group of people there to coordinate. And then our festival could not happen without volunteers. We have a large volunteer group, and you can sign up to be one on our website.
Oh, so you do still need volunteers?
As far as I know, they still have open positions.
Perfect.
Yes. And so it takes all those people. Last year, I think I estimated it was close to 300 people that it took to put this whole thing together and pull it off.
Yeah.
And we're expecting 1,000 registrants this year. I think we had 850 last year.
1,000. So, and these are all people that are coming to the area.
Right.
Well, I mean, locals, people from out of town. Where do you find, do people stay mainly in Morro Bay, or are they all over the county?
They do tend to scatter out, but, you know, kind of radiating out, if you will, from Morro Bay. We did a survey last year of our attendees, and one of the interesting statistics is we found that 72% of the people who attend live outside the 934 zip code.
Oh.
So what that means is they can't go home at night.
Right.
So let's say it's 1,000 people. That's going to be 720 people that need a place to stay and food to eat and transportation, et cetera. So it's a big boost to the local economy on the Central Coast here.
Yeah. Oh, gosh. That sounds like it. And in January, too, like I said, the weather's perfect.
Yeah. We have a lot of people coming from Michigan and Minnesota.
Yeah. Yep. That's right around the time where they're looking for somewhere else to go. How about events for children?
Children. Yes. I'm glad you asked. On Saturday, we have Family Day. And that takes place at the Morro Bay Community Center, which is our festival headquarters. And it's an all-day event. It's open to families with kids to come in. There's all kinds of games and educational things that they can do, and it's free. You don't have to be registered to come to that event. We do it every year, and it's every year it gets more and more successful.
Yeah. Do you find kids? Do they enjoy the birding?
Yeah, well, they learn about it. I think they basically learn a little bit about it there. And then there's other organizations that are going into the schools now and actually doing education classes. Mm-hmm. I know Morro Coast Audubon is very active in that.
Yeah.
So it's good. Yeah, we need those young birders coming along to replace us older birders.
Older, maybe a little bit.
Yeah.
A little bit older. If you're just joining us, this is Issues and Ideas, KCBX Public Radio, and I'm Carol Tangerman. My guest today is Bob Revel of the Morro Bay Bird Festival, and it's coming up in January 15th to the 19th, 2026. And tickets are at morrobaybirdfestival.org. We are talking about it now because the tickets just went on sale, and events, they're popular. This is a popular event. What other things do you have going on that you enjoy? Let's say someone they love birds, but they're not, you know, not really mobile enough to maybe want to do the field trips.
Mm-hmm.
What other things are there?
Well, that's when you would maybe consider going to some of the presentations. And we've got a number of those. Let's see if I can. I think we have about 23 of those going this year. And they're on different topics and always stuff of interest. And the other thing that would be of interest, I think, is they might want to go to our keynote events. We have on Saturday night and Sunday night, we have two keynote speakers at Cuesta CPAC, and that's a big hall, 450 people, and the speakers are going to talk on some interesting things. Can I talk about one of those?
You sure can.
Okay, well, one of our speakers is a gentleman named Dorian Anderson, and back in 2014, Dorian decided to do something different for a year, take away from his work as a molecular biologist. And he decided to get on his bicycle and ride around the U.S. and do what we call a big year. And he did. He left Boston in a snowstorm and ended up biking around and saw, I think, over 600 different birds. He bicycled about 17,000 miles, and he wrote a book about it, and he's going to be talking about that. And it's a fascinating story. He did not set foot in a motorized vehicle for a year.
It was all on his bicycle.
Yes, yes.
And so is that a common thing you mentioned earlier, the big year?
Very common. Very common. People do it. You can do a big day. You can do a big year.
I saw many big days, probably one for each day of the festival.
Yes.
You know, big day. And then there's another one, Los Osos Big Day.
Those are, go see as many different kind of birds as you can.
Check them off your list.
Check them off the list. We do a Christmas bird count in Morro Bay every year. And that's usually in the middle of December, which is close to the festival time. And we see usually over 200 birds. So that shows you we have such a good variety of birds here, and that's why people are coming. That's the main attraction. It's the birds.
Yeah, yeah. One last thing, just quickly. If people are out just getting excited about birding, and they're out on their own. Any tips for someone who's just out and about birding? Any safety or precautions?
Well, you obviously want to, you know, do the right things and not go onto someone's property without asking permission. What I would recommend is that if you're really interested in learning, that you go with a group. Because number one, you'll learn more, you'll learn where to go. If you don't want to go with a group, then use some of the online resources. For example, Morro Coast Audubon has a list on their website of all the birding spots to go to in the Central Coast. So, yeah, good safety. But to get good, you really want to go with people that know more about the birds and listen and learn.
Yeah, keep their distance. Stay quiet.
Stay quiet and bring a good pair of binoculars.
Yeah, yeah. Or a camera with one of those long lenses.
Yes, yes.
Well, Bob, anything else? Any final thoughts?
No, except we want to thank you again for letting us come, and we hope everybody listening will maybe take a chance to come by. We do have a marketplace at our festival headquarters that's open to the public. Come by, and we have a lot of vendors there that are offering different things. We have artists. We have optics companies. So, you know, stop by and say hello.
Where is your
at the Morro Bay Community Center in Morro Bay.
Yes. All right. Well, this is exciting, and this is coming up. It's coming up in January, the Morro Bay Bird Festival, but we're talking about it now. Tickets just went on sale. This is Issues and Ideas on KCBX Public Radio. I'm Carol Tangeman, my guest Bob Revel of the Morro Bay Bird Festival. And to get tickets and just explore their wonderful website, it's at morrobaybirdfestival.org. Bob, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having us.
I'm KCBX's Natalia Young with Molly Kern, CEO at the Slo Food Bank, to talk about how the shutdown is affecting local families and options moving forward. Thank you for joining me today, Molly.
Thanks for having me.
What are you seeing on the ground right now? Have you noticed an increase in demand or any changes in who's coming to the food bank?
So right now we're really preparing for the November 1st delay in CalFresh or SNAP benefits. We expect 30,000 Slo County residents to not get the money that they usually get every month in order to buy their groceries at local grocery stores and farmers markets.
How many people in Slo County regularly come to the food bank?
So as a food bank network, we are serving an average of about 45,000 people every month. But separately, about 30,000 people get additional support from the federal government through SNAP or CalFresh program.
And Governor Gavin Newsom announced that $80 million will be dedicated to help local jurisdictions with CalFresh cuts. So is there an estimate of how much of that will go towards Slo County residents in need?
So that was actually money that was approved by the legislature and the governor much earlier this year. We were really grateful to have that support. And the Slo Food Bank is getting about $770,000 this year. And we've already started spending it, and it allows us to purchase California grown and produced food in order to distribute it to our neighbors in need.
So is that being fast-tracked then? What was the most recent update?
So there are some administrative changes that were offered to food banks in the way that we utilize that money. That was the big announcement.
How have you used that money?
So it's really incredible that we're able to use these funds to purchase California, and oftentimes also locally grown produce is incredible. It's also right now supporting milk and eggs that we get out to families in need. California is really an incredible agricultural and food state. And so we get to be able to access so many amazing, healthy, delicious foods and make sure that they are regularly in supply to our neighbors who we're serving all across Slo County.
Recently, Newsom also deployed the National Guard to help food banks. Are service members expected to come to Slo County?
So it's an amazing opportunity for some food banks that can at times have challenges getting enough volunteers or really human power to be able to move all of the food around. In SLO, we have already seen an outpouring of support, and our volunteer shifts have signed up so quickly with local people who are really committed to helping their neighbors. So at this point, we don't envision needing that support, but it's wonderful to know that it's there in case we do.
Do you have an estimate? I know that you said that it's kind of a tough math equation, but do you have an estimate of how long the food bank can sustain this level of demand if the shutdown does continue?
So with the delay, we're expecting that 30,000 people would need additional support from the SLO Food Bank. About 18,000 of those people, we estimate, are already occasionally working with the food bank to meet their needs. But there's about 12,000 who would be newly turning to the SLO Food Bank and our network of agency partners, possibly for the first time. And so there's a lot of different things to consider with how we support this this new need in this new way. And we're confident that over, you know, a short period of time, we can absolutely meet this need. And we're really grateful that so many partners have already leaned in to extend their partnership as we look to be prepared to make sure we're meeting this need, regardless of how long the shutdown continues.
Well, I'm so glad to hear that locally, the food bank seems pretty secure in its ability to support people, you know, in nutrition and community as well. What message do you want policymakers and the public to understand about how shutdowns affect food security here, but especially in places where they may not have this amount of resources?
So I think one of the most heartbreaking things that we have already seen is a tremendous increase in the number of calls and visits and really conversations that we're having with people who are terrified of what this delay in benefit means to them. They're really uncertain about how long it will last, as we all are. And that level of additional concern and instability really impacts our entire community. So that's the biggest impact is really on people who now are having to deal with one more thing that is not there for them when they need it. And all of us need nutritious food every single day. There is absolutely no reason that anyone shouldn't be able to access that food, particularly in a community like ours that has such amazing agricultural bounty. And so I think the human impact is the most important thing to know. Secondarily, this delay also means that about $6 million in a given month that would normally be going into local businesses like grocery stores and at farmers markets just won't be available to spend there. And so the ripple effects are significant. Our food system is deeply interconnected with everyone's lives, with family connection, with culture, but also with our economy. And so the ripple effects really can't be overstated. When something like this, a pillar of life for so many thousands of people in our community, is disrupted.
Are there any other notes that you have about how you're feeling, both as the CEO of the food bank, moving into, you know, the 3 weeks of the shutdown, or even personally?
I think the most important thing is really that we are encouraging people, if you are curious about if the food bank can help you, if you have any questions about the type of food that's available, where you can get food, how it all works, please, please, please give us a call or go to our website. You can go to findfoodslo.org to find so much information about the different opportunities that might fit well into your life. Really importantly, getting food for yourself and your family doesn't take it away from someone else. So there is no need to think that because of this delay, you are taking food away from another family by getting the food that you need through the SLO Food Bank. So I would really encourage everyone who is in need or thinks that they might be in a position where additional support would be valuable to please reach out to see if there is something that we can do to support you in this time. It really helps keep our entire community strong and thriving.
And how can people see the locations where they can pick up food throughout the county if they're not local to SLO?
So yeah, food bank services are really all throughout SLO County. It is not a city service at all. So you can go to findfoodslo.org to find all of the different pantry and food distribution locations. We are everywhere from east to as far as California Valley to San Simeon, up in San Miguel and Lake Nacimiento, all the way down to Oceano and Napomo. So in addition to making sure that everyone has the food that they need, we recognize that some people are really interested in leaning in and being a part of this incredible team that helps support our neighbors in times of crisis like this. And so if that's you, we would be so honored to have you donate. You can go to slofoodbank.org to make a donation or give us a call if you have any questions. But those financial donations make such an amazing difference, especially right now when we are working so rapidly to source additional food and quickly get it out to our neighbors.
If you'd like to donate to the San Luis Obispo Food Bank, you can do so by visiting slowfoodbank.org or by calling 805-238-4664. You've been listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX, public radio for the Central Coast. Our theme music comes from Gary Eister, and a big thank you to all of our guests and contributors. I'm David McAbee. Join me every Monday from 1 to 2 for more stories, more voices, and more of what makes our community tick. And if you miss something or just want to hear it again, you'll find every conversation waiting for you at kcbx.org. And before we go, let's end with some new music. This is Horse Girl with their song Julie. And remember, the best stories are right here at home. Thanks for listening, and I'll see you next week. This is KCBX.
Julie. There's something on your plate. mistakes to make with you. I want them to.
Saw that.